All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of the On Par Win It podcast with Kieran Clark of GolfShake.com fame. How you doing, Kieran?
I'm good, Anthony, and having just recovered now watching the great victory of Adam Scott, and on the night of the Oscars, the night of the Academy Awards, isn't it fantastic to see a script play out in the game where a player who is written off by certain broadcasters, certain radio hosts, proves them wrong and comes back to win again on the tour? It's a great Hollywood story, straight out of Rocky Balboa. But Anthony, I'm not sure who we can get to play the broadcaster. Could it be you, maybe?
Yeah, I take I take full credit for the motivating Adam Scott. I think he needed a little. I think he needed a little kick in the you know what, and he responded in kind.
Well, he certainly did, and of course, again, perhaps proof and evidence that if, ladies and gentlemen, if you want inaccurate predictions and reports, then listen to this podcast.
You got that right. I mean, it's unbelievable. Everybody we mention has come to the surface of the golfing world.
And you know what? The one person we haven't mentioned so far is Tiger Woods. So if we actually start talking about him, maybe he will actually be resurrected again back on the course.
I think he needs more than us.
Divine intervention, I think.
I think he does. He does. He needs someone between the mad scientist of Frankenstein and someone someone other than us, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Someone other than us, yeah.
So what your takeaway from, let's get right to it, the Honda Classic. I thought the course did what it usually does. It's not going to be, you know, as they said in the telecast, it likens to a more of a major championship test, a major championship kind of field. It sort of has all the makings of a grind fest, and you know, I'm okay with that, I have to say. I think the golf course is what it is, and I think it requires, you know, it's a specific test, and I'm okay with the golf course. How about you?
Yeah, I think as far as Florida golf courses go, it's up there with the best. Most of them tend to look the same, but I think this one has a little bit more subtlety in certain places that actually separates it from most of them, and not the least next week's one at Doral. But I think you're right there about the major championship aspect to this. And for me, with Adam Scott, the way he's played in the last 2 weeks, he's played particularly well, exceptionally well at times, on two extremely demanding golf courses, and indeed slightly different golf courses. And that bodes well for him. You know, not just winning an event and getting back to form, but actually playing well on courses of that nature. It bodes well for him going into the majors this summer.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm still, you know, interested in his putting in the long term. And I did. I did get on him. I take full, you know, it's on record.
Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Listen back to about maybe 22 minutes in. You'll hear exactly what Anthony thought about Adam Scott.
Exactly. And I'll tell you exactly. I did. I just didn't think he had it in him. And it's not like I didn't know how much he won before. I mean, he had won the bulk of his tournaments, obviously, with the short putter. It's not like I was ignorant to the fact. I just didn't see him, for someone who was as shaky as he was, with the long putter, and even having won the two majors, I didn't see this coming. I really didn't. I'm happy for him. I think he's a good guy in golf. I'm pleased to be wrong. There's no question about that. I totally didn't see it coming from him.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it necessarily either, but he has shown some relatively decent form of late. At the end of last year, he had a good finish in the event in South Korea, then he played well in the Australian Open. So he had some form coming into this season, but obviously there was that big question mark for a lot of these players, but particularly with him, a guy who at times, even with the long putter, didn't look particularly accomplished either. So it was a tough kind of ask for him psychologically, but he seems to overcome it. I think he putted very well at times, looked very solid over the ball. And actually, what struck me most actually was his long game was really impressive this week. You know, yesterday in particular, he had one disaster, of course. I think it was on 15 when he made quadruple bogey. But apart from that, he played exceptionally well yesterday. Really could have shot 62, 63. And today as well, for the most part, he played really well. I think in some ways, he was partially aided today. One of the fact that, as you say, it's a very much a grinder's kind of finish, particularly on a Sunday with the pressure. It's a very psychologically demanding golf course with so much water around, so much danger, and you're always fraught with that doubt. And to overcome that is perhaps harder than on a particular shootout kind of golf course. And he did that. But I think also he was helped by the fact that playing alongside him was a guy who hasn't been particularly convincing either in pressure situations, of course, in more recent times in particular, in Sergio Garcia.
Yeah.
I think Sergio, at times Adam played solidly throughout, but there was a couple of instances, particularly in the back nine, I think 15, 16, where Adam made a couple of mistakes, but Sergio made them as well. And that was really, maybe perhaps a more confident player, a more assured player, more assertive player, might have actually put Adam under pressure on those moments. But that said, the shot he played at 17 was absolutely fantastic, and the drive on 18 was just, it sealed the deal and was really, really confident. And I think he kind of breathed a big sigh of relief there at the end when he held that short putt in the last. But I think it's just a, it's probably for him now, it's the next chapter of his career. He's won now with the shorter putter again. He's even won without Stevie Williams in the bag, who of course was a big influence on him in terms of the creating more of a steely edge to him as he has had the success a few years ago. But you know, Adam, he's one of those guys who we all know how good he is, and he's so capable and could easily be a contender when we get towards Augusta.
I agree. A big win for him. And now that I think about it, and I was thinking about his the kind of day that he had and the kind of tournament he had, I did say in the first podcast, one of the things that I did note, not that I'm going back on anything, and I totally stand up for what I had said, and I'll take it on the chin for that. But I did say, think about this golf course and what it required today, and it really played to his strength, where it wasn't a putting contest, so that was in his favor. It was a driver's golf course, that's in his favor, so check that box. And then the last box to tick was it required patience, which he does have. So I think, in fairness to myself and my original report, and I still, like I said, stand by it, it did, you know, the bulk of the heavy lifting was done with the things that are the strengths of his game. He didn't rely on his putting. He needed to drive the ball well. That's a driving golf course. There's no doubt about it. And you need patience, which he does have. So, you know, I'm not trying to take away anything that he did today, but the strengths of what was required today and this week definitely played into his hands.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the same last week at Riviera, which is also a ball striker's golf course.
Yeah.
And even Sergio Garcia, of course, is renowned for his ball striking, not for his putting either. Obviously being up there this week as well as another sign of it being a ball striker's golf course, Riviera, and PGA National, and indeed Riviera last week, of course, with Bubba winning there, one of the best ball strikers in the game. So that's true, but I think that will bode well for him when we get towards Augusta. Because if Augusta itself, we talk about the putting there, how fast the greens are, how undulating they are, and they are obviously the most severe greens you'll see all year. But at the same time, Augusta is a second-shot golf course, and I do think that as well plays into Adam Scott's hands. In the end, it doesn't matter how great a putter you are at Augusta, if you start missing the missing greens or the ball above the hole, you're not going to last long there. And I think Adam Scott and guys like Bubba, even though they're perhaps not the greatest putters in the world, at the same time they can get round up the fact that they're great drivers of the ball, which obviously now at Augusta how long it is, obviously a massive asset there, and also great iron players because the greens there are obviously so severe. And I think Adam is, he's also speaking very confidently. He has great big ambitions about his putting. He wants to get up the rankings and be among the best in the game. Obviously quite a heady sort of ambition to have. But he's talking well. He's talking confidently. I think he's, I think he was frustrated last year. Adam Scott, we kind of have the impression of being quite a soft guy, but I think there's a steely nerve to him there that perhaps isn't always obvious on the outside. I think he has got a determination to him. He might have had maybe last year the eye was off the ball slightly, obviously having his first child and so on, and that can happen. Very understandable, of course. Happened to a lot of other players down the years. So now I think Adam's back here to try and come out and play some golf. He realises now he's in his mid-30s. This is kind of his last sort of window to have success. And maybe the shorter putter, he's out there trying to prove everybody wrong, maybe even himself. And that's kind of an ambition to have, kind of a motivation to go out there and succeed. But so far this year, he's looked very good, and it bodes well for him going into the spring and into the summer. So I'm looking forward to see if Adam Scott can actually carry this on and be more consistent when we get towards the bigger events and the more pressure situations.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well, and I hope he does. And I think that's a really, a good point that you make, and I think a lot of people forget that he's so in the sense that he does have a bit of an edge to him, and when he talks, he's certainly very honest when he talks on the telecast, when he gets interviewed.
Yeah.
He's that disaster that he had on 17 on Saturday night was he answered it straightforward and didn't mix any words or make any excuses, and it was a terrible shot the first one, and then he hit it and thought the wind would knock it down, and thought it was a good shot. He was just as like surprised as all of us. So, you know, I just like the way he carries himself. But I think you make a real good point, and that's in the sense that he does have that little bit of an edge to him that I think we don't always see, and we take it for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just say that actually, I think he's the first player to win on the PGA Tour having made a quadruple bogey or worse since Phil Mickelson in 2009. And he's one of only three players to actually do that in the last sort of 32 years since we've been recording the stats on the PGA Tour. So that takes a nerve to overcome. A lot of younger players, maybe a lot of more temperamental players, might have not overcome such a disaster in one particular hole, might have thrown away all the good stuff that came before it.
Yep.
And indeed, one man I mentioned earlier, maybe Bubba. You know, how would have Bubba reacted to making a quad on a hole? He might have not recovered from that at all, even though the next day, obviously, coming back from it. But you know, Adam has that. You know, that kind of steely nerve to him, it is there, it is present, and he's had a lot of ups and downs in his career. Had a great success, obviously, when he came out on the tour in his early 20s, kind of drifted a little bit, went to the long putter, had won the Masters and so on. Now he's had a slight dip in form since then, but now he's showing signs to get back to that higher level. And, you know, anyone that does that, you know, they've got a strong nerve. And even though he is quite mild-mannered, he is honest and he's well-spoken, quietly spoken in his own way, when you actually listen to what he says and you read between the lines, he has got an edge there. And I think that's something we, as you say, we do overlook at times. Easily done. He's not one of the most flamboyant players in the tour, but he does in his own way talk a very strong game.
Yep, absolutely. And then there's poor Sergio on the other side. And
yeah.
He was just, it was almost, you know, the thing about golf is just, you just watch people sort of unravel right in front of your eyes. And Sergio just looks like a guy, you know, like you said, that Adam Scott was, you know, starting to believe in himself. I'm not sure Sergio, you know, he just doesn't have that kind of makeup, and he doesn't exude that kind of confidence. He doesn't emote that kind of confidence. He just looks like a guy who is, he just, you know, it almost looks like, let just get me out of this moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He's someone who he spent many years now talking about, he's someone who actually believes in the myth of the golfing gods who are against him.
Yeah.
And that's a very unhealthy mindset to have if you're a top tour professional. You know, regular guys like you and me have that sort of mindset, but we're foolish and don't have good swings and that's our problem. But he is someone who's a top player, has an immense level of talent, as we know, but he just doesn't seem to have the mental strength to harness it effectively enough. And the thing is, you can kind of understand that when he was younger, but the odd thing about Sergio is he seemed more assured with himself when he was younger.
Yeah.
And that's an odd thing. Most players go in reverse where they start off kind of, you know, raw and whatever, and then they develop as they get older, but he sort of regressed mentally at times. And it is quite inexplicable, and it is a rare thing. And it is unfortunate because he has a great level of talent, as we know. He's a fantastic ball striker. But even today, he was talking afterwards about how his ball striking didn't feel quite right, and that was maybe the case, I don't know. But he's still there and thereabouts, so if he played well enough. But at the same time, watching Sergio, you're never convinced he's going to do something at the right moment, hit the right shot, and put pressure on the other guy. And we are Adam Scott, and the two of them are very good friends. They know each other very well, and Adam probably never felt at one point really intimidated by Sergio. He's not someone you feel intimidated by because you actually think he's going to make a mistake himself. You know, who's going to blink first in kind of a head-to-head duel? It's usually going to be Sergio. And I think that made Adam Scott's job easier this evening because he was able to go out there. He played well. Played solid, don't get me wrong. But even when he made mistakes, Sergio was not there to capitalize on them. Many other players would have done. And you know, I think the shot in 17 is an example of that, where Sergio had to make something happen and he pulled his tee shot way left. Open door for Adam Scott. He hit a great shot. If Sergio finds the green, hits a good shot there, I'm not sure Adam hits the shot quite as confidently as he did. So Sergio didn't really even though he was only one shot behind, he never really felt like he was actually going to overtake Adam. It always felt like Adam had him at kind of arm's length the whole time. And that's a problem for Sergio. We all know how good he can be, how good he has been at times, but there is always that big question mark with him there. And it's a psychological one, and that's obviously the hardest one to rectify. But as I say, it is odd how the fact that, I don't know if you agree or not, Anthony, but he seems to have actually regressed mentally as time has gone on. I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, he makes, you know, three bogeys on the back nine. He did make two birdies, but the three bogeys all basically were when it seemed like Adam Scott was making his bogey. And so
exactly.
he was never able to, you know, and the misses were, either, you know, way left or way short. It was just, you know, it was, you know, it's easy to say my ball striking wasn't there. But, you know, the bottom line is you put yourself in that position regardless of how your ball striking was. You're in the final group of the day. So I just, you know, the fact that he couldn't scratch it together is just more evidence, as we know, that he has sort of never, you know, has mentally regressed in his throughout his career. And who knows what's going on in his personal life or whatever the case may be. He seems to be very sensitive to the ebbs and flows of life, and that sort of seems to penetrate his world of golf fairly easily. And so, you know, it was just a shame. And I guess it was a shame for us as, you know, from the entertainment standpoint, because I would have liked to seen them really go battle for battle, and in a sense, they actually kind of did, because, you know, Adam Scott went 34-36. He was one under on the front, and Sergio was even on the front and one over on the back, or even on the, you know, one over on the front and even on the back. And so he ends up one over, one over on the back, excuse me. So so there's the two shots right there between the front nine and the back nine, but he only needed one of those, to be honest with you. And so so it was almost, you know, it still was relatively close, but it never felt close, I guess you could say. Never was, from an entertainment standpoint, it was a dull kind of round. But, you know, it was more like we were wondering if someone was going to fall apart, or if, you know, and it turns out, well, Sergio is the one who did it. And it's not like he just totally collapsed. He just couldn't get over he just couldn't make the turn is what he couldn't do.
Yeah, he just kept making, you know, poor mistakes after Adam had done so. And actually, the worst thing you can do in any sort of sport is let your opponent get away with making a mistake. And he did that continually in the back nine. And in the end, eventually, Scott was going to start hitting better shots. And he did that, of course, in the last two holes, and eventually sealed the deal doing that. But Sergio, as you say, even though on paper it was very close, if you only saw the paper and saw the leaderboard, you think, well, that was a close round, must have been quite exciting to watch. But on the context how the holes all played out, how the round played out, you know, it always felt like Adam was just so much more assured. And even then, he wasn't that assured compared to what other players may have been. But had Adam been alongside a more determined, more, you know, confident player, then maybe if Adam was alongside somebody like a Justin Thomas, who he was not too far behind, but obviously a younger guy, a bit more brash, a bit more assertive, maybe that would have been different. A different dynamic. But you had almost two guys there who were almost waiting for the other to make mistakes, and then when one made a mistake, the other guy followed him. Yeah. And unfortunately for Sergio, Adam had a decent start early on, edged ahead and retained that lead. But for Sergio going forward, you know, it's, for me, his career now is almost where every 2 years he fights to get on the Ryder Cup team, he does that, then he goes away again and comes back again 2 years after that. And it feels like a, you know, such a waste of a great talent. Remember how exciting a player he was back in 99 when he emerged there against Tiger, of course, at the PGA, and the great success that he had as a young guy, how exuberant he was as a personality. And I know people obviously mellow as they get older at times, but Sergio seemed to do even more than mellow. He seemed to almost become depressed in the golf course in terms of he didn't look like he was enjoying it at all. I remember he had that meltdown a few years ago, I think it was at Whistling Straits, the PGA, where he attacked a bunker and took a break from the game. And things like that have happened with him. Obviously, off the golf course, different things happen to you, and that can affect your game, and that's perfectly understandable. That's just how life works for us all. And unfortunately, these guys are obviously in the spotlight, and that makes it even harder. But at the same time, you know, Sergio, for someone who has such a great level of talent and has, you know, a tremendous level of success compared to most people in the game, it never looks like he actually enjoys it. And it almost seems like he enjoys the game more when he's in another environment, like a team environment, like he is at the Ryder Cup. He comes out of his shell there. He enjoys that experience. But when he's on his own, he doesn't seem to handle it very well. Maybe he doesn't handle pressure well, not just from everybody else, but actually internal pressure. Mm-hmm. And again, that's probably going to be the kind of footnote of his career where we think, well, what could have been? The tools were there, but he just never quite had the mentality to utilize them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, it's amazing to me, the 180, because you're right, because he has been stripped of all the joy that, you know, the game brings. And he's gone 180 degrees, because the joy in which he started with in the game is mm-hmm. been sucked from him. And quite frankly, it seems mostly been done by him to himself, through his own attitude and whatnot. But it's amazing how high he was and now how low he is. I mean, he just doesn't look like he enjoys the game. And you're right. I feel like he should just be, you know, he should just play the European Tour until it's a Ryder Cup year, and then kind of do his thing, and then play on the Ryder Cup and be close enough to at least get picked, and then or just ride around in a cart and just be the sidekick. I mean, he seems to be comfortable with that. He's happy with that. He loves that situation, and it seems like that's the way it's going to play out for the rest of his career.
Yeah, the thing with Sergio is, you're right there about that. I remember actually, of course, when he had that sabbatical from the game in 2010, he actually was named a vice-captain for the 2010 Ryder Cup by Colin Montgomery, I think it was, and he was there, and he actually hung around with the team and became a guy on the sidelines and actually was motivated by that to actually be in that environment 2 years after that, and of course he achieved that at Medina. But Sergio, you go back to what happened to him, I think, with Harrington at Carnoustie.
No question.
Following year at Oakland Hills. Had that moment where those two defeats, I think they were really crushing to him. Because he was at a stage of his career where he still had a relative level of exuberance. He was still relatively young, but he had enough experience at the same time. He had been in that position before. Obviously, I ran Tiger relatively close as anybody could have done at Hoylake the previous year in the Open Championship, and then he went to Carnoustie. He should have won that comfortably in the end. He threw that one away in a really glaring manner. That's even more so, you know, we talk about Van de Velde in 99 there, but you know, Sergio at times as well was almost as bad in a more sort of less dramatic manner. And then, of course, the following year as well, with Harrington sort of snatched the PGA from him. I often wonder, you know, where Sergio would have been now, you know, 5-6 years on from, almost a decade on from that now, you know, had he actually claimed one of those two majors, because it seemed after that point he sort of convinced himself that he couldn't do it, and that's obviously the worst trap to fall in. It's fine, guys like me or you saying, oh, this guy can't do this guy can't win this, but when a player himself doesn't actually believe it, then it's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, and it's a good point. I think when we look back on his career, the fulcrum of his career had definitely turned at the Open Championship, and the way it unfolded, the way he handled it afterwards with the, you know, complaining about waiting for the rake and the guy doing the rake job in the greenside bunker at 18, and how it took 15 minutes to rake a bunker and why did it take so long. And then to, you know, and not only to think it, but then to actually articulate it in the press conference by saying, sometimes I think I'm fighting against other, you know, some things other than golfers. And when you start talking, you know, when you start getting all like, you know, transcendentalist, you know, on us, you know, nothing good's going to come from that.
No, he was getting a bit sort of metaphysical with all that the gods were against him. And when you start doing that, it's a very slippery slope indeed, in all sorts of walks of life, but particularly in golf, of course, which again, of course, is a game that puts a lot of pressure on our minds anyway. But he's someone who almost seems to invite that mental sort of pressure on himself. And it's almost as if he's got some sort of masochistic attitude at times, where he puts himself in situations and says things almost to... It's as if when he gets to a tournament And when he fails or he comes up just short in the end, he hasn't surprised himself. And he's almost like a satisfaction that, well, that's what I expected anyway.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if he actually is almost afraid of proving himself wrong at times, that he can actually, you know, cross that line. And I thought he may have done that in the Open a couple of years ago when he obviously was there with Rory and Ricky Fowler at Hoylake, and he just didn't, again, on the back nine, he fell apart. And it seems to be a recurring theme, and the longer it happens, the less likely it's going to change, unfortunately. Because I would like to see him win a major, because I think he has the talent level to deserves one of them. It's a bit like Colin Montgomery as well. Whatever you may think of Colin Montgomery, you know, there's no question he's one of the best golfers of his generation, and certainly talent-wise deserved a major. But the same sort of you know, attitude existed with Colin Montgomery as well, where he blamed everything but himself. And usually with both Monty, it was the crowd or the other people. But with Sergio, it seems to be almost the gods. And unfortunately, Monty could control the crowd at times, but you can't control the gods.
No, you can't. But I will tell you this, deserve has nothing to do with it, you know. And that's...
Well, that is true. It's probably the wrong choice of words, yeah.
You know, and that's just the bottom line. And it's just, you know, it's just going to be an interesting, you know... way, I think it's just going to be interesting to see the way the rest of his career plays out. I suspect it's going to continue to muddle along just the way it is, and unless it kind of falls into his hands. But let's move on from one collapse to another. Ricky Fowler, if that isn't example enough of how fickle the game can be, goes out 66 66 and then comes back with 74 on Saturday in the final group. I mean, the final group and the next to final group, there couldn't have been a more of a difference between the two. I think there was like a 14-shot difference between the two groups on Saturday. It was just ugly, and then, you know, he just never factored, obviously. But, you know, that's what the game will do to you.
Yeah, indeed. And Ricky's had sort of endured a bit of frustration recently, obviously at Phoenix, where he really should have won that, made a couple of mistakes in terms of club selection and so on on the 17th hole there, and lost in that playoff to Matsuyama. So a bit of a knock there. And obviously a knock here, you know, the tournament's really in his grasp on Friday evening, looked very confident, looked like he played great, he was a man to back for the weekend, but as you say, it just flouted, and that's just, it's just golf, and that's just how it goes. And but at times when you play as well as he has done recently, and how much work he's put into his game, and how confident he is, that must be really frustrating for him. Obviously, he thought he was going to come back from that disappointment at Phoenix and really, you know, put that behind him this week in Florida, but it didn't quite happen for him. But at the same time, Ricky is obviously, you know, he's playing well enough. You know, one bad round and one mediocre round. You know, it's not the end of the world. Came at the wrong time, of course, but there's still a lot of good golf there, and Ricky's still going to really factor this season in the big events. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And I think Ricky has on contrast to Sergio, I think Ricky has the right attitude to deal with adversity.
Yeah.
I think that's why he's played well at times in bad weather and so on. And he's overcome a lot in his career where people were doubting him, you know, obviously publicly and in fairly extravagant manners. That poll that came out, and he was the most overrated player and so on. I know we kind of drew that out a bit too much, but at the same time, it was there. And there was a lot of talk about that. He's more style over substance, but I always thought he was a very substantive golfer and had a great quality to his game. And he's now showing that in the last couple of years. I expect him to really progress going forward. And for him, disappointment there, but Ricky is someone who I think will overcome that relatively comfortably, and I expect him to play well in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I do too. And I wonder how much of this week, and maybe he just hit a wall emotionally. You know, mm-hmm. I know his dad was there again this weekend, and so he might have had that. He might have had that going. You know, maybe he was looking, maybe, you know, trying a little too hard, or just couldn't muster up the energy. Because you know, it does take a lot out of you, and to have what happened to him in Phoenix, you know, kind of torn away from him, whether he did it himself to himself or not, it's still an emotional roller. It's emotionally taxing, is really what it is. And and he's been up there a couple of times already this year. So maybe he just hit a wall. He's played quite a bit in the last couple of weeks, who knows how many outings he's had to do on the Mondays or wherever else he's been doing, you know, on his off weeks. But so maybe he just kind of, you know, maybe it just all kind of just came crashing down and just needs a week off to reboot or whatever. And although he won't get it next week, right? He's got the World Golf with at Doral, so he won't get it next week. But maybe he just kind of hit like a little bit of a wall, and maybe a new fresh week will you know, turn the corner for him.
And we said earlier, you know, PGA National itself as a course, it's so easy to, you know, it's a course of real fine margins. And the margins, when you follow those margins, it's very severe, the penalty. And it's easy to kind of fall into traps. You're not quite on your game. The wind was blowing about at times. And actually played better when the weather was bad, oddly enough, which actually kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about how good he is in bad conditions and how he has a good attitude. But you're right with the thing about his dad being there. Perhaps the answer is actually stop inviting his family to tournaments. He might actually win one of them again. He won in Abu Dhabi, and I'm pretty sure none of his family were there.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. All right, let's move on to something a little more positive. Another South African wins in Australia, or just
dominating the European Tour this year.
It's unbelievable. We were just talking about this last week, and you know what? It was awesome to see Louis Oosthuizen playing the way he was. He was just, I mean, I think he hit it wasn't a record, but I think he hit 94% of his greens in regulation for the week. I mean, that's just absurd, really. Only six other people have done better in a full week's tournament, you know, a four-day tournament. So it just goes to show you how rare that is. But just lovely to see him playing the way in top form, and really just a great tournament to watch.
Yeah, it is. Actually, and a very good golf course that as well.
Yeah.
But Louis is someone who, we just look at the way he plays, and as you said, I think it was actually, he only missed five greens in regulation all week, 67 out of 72, which is obviously astonishing. And that's just what he can do. We all know, you know, I'm not someone who's an expert in the golf swing, but you watch his swing, it just looks so picture perfect. It has that tremendous fluency. It's almost metronomic. It's just like watching a robot swing a golf club.
Yep.
It's incredible. And when he's on, he is among the top five players in the world for me, no question, because I think he has such an ability to hit shots at key moments other players just don't have. But at the same time, you know, he sort of flatters to deceive at times as well, where he disappears,
right,
partly due to injury at times. I also think Louis has he doesn't quite have the same level of determination as many other players have. I think he is quite happy at home. He enjoys his home life, and that's great. He enjoys his lifestyle. And the game isn't always the main thing for him, and that's the way it should be. But at the same time, he doesn't perhaps quite have the same hunger that many of the young guys have, the Jordan Spieth and so on, who want to come on in the game and actually prove themselves. And I think many of the guys who are in their 30s right now are in a situation where they're competing against guys in their early 20s who don't have as many distractions away from the game, and therefore their main focus is actually on golf, while the older guys have to sort of balance the two things between family and the game and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to get that balance right, but I think we're seeing some of these older guys are actually starting to get that balance right now. And Louis, we know when he's on, he's so good. And he's really reminded us that he's still there, because we were going towards Augusta, where, of course, he came so close to winning 4 years ago, to lost that playoff to Bubba. And Louis came so close to winning two majors last year. We forget that as well. You know, at Chambers Bay, he was unquestionably by far the best player of the last three rounds. So he played incredibly well on Friday, Saturday, Sunday there. Had a bad first round, but recovered from it so well. And then, of course, at the Open Championship, losing the playoff there. So Louis is someone who, you know, in terms of his quality as a golfer, it is unquestioned. And maybe at times in the run-of-the-mill, week-to-week events, he doesn't quite do as well as he really should do. But when you put your equipment in that situation where he's on a golf course that he likes, he enjoys the big situations, when it matters to him, he can really turn it on. And I expect Louis to be a real contender at Augusta this year. I think he's someone, we talk about Spieth and Rory and so on, but for me, I think, you know, Bubba's the guy, but I think right behind him, Louis stays right there again, because I just think his game is so well suited to really any golf course. He's one of those guys who can seem to adapt his game to anywhere, because his swing is so good. He hits the ball so well. And if he can get the putter working even slightly better than he was today, because he was a little bit shaky to start off this morning there, a few mistakes early on. The players didn't really punish him for that, and he recovered from it and won quite comfortably in the end, even with a bogey in the last hole. But at the same time, you know, Louis is someone who, you know, we rate really highly, and I think Anthony, he's going to be, I would not be surprised, Anthony, he actually wins, you know, at least in our major in his career, because I think he's someone who's just, I know you said earlier, a player doesn't deserve to win one, but Louis seems almost too good not to win in our major.
Yeah. Well, all I have to do is just tell him he'll never win another major
again. Exactly. You just say he's finished. That's it.
End of story. But, you know, he reminds me of, he's like the, Louis Oosthuizen is like the European version of Boo Weekly. And I mean that in the sense that, no, don't get me wrong, they're two different swings, one much more prettier than the other. But the thing about Boo Weekly is that he almost rather be hunting than be playing golf. And I think Louis Oosthuizen rather be on his tractor that he won at the John Deere and on his farm than playing golf. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he'd be, if he had to walk away from golf right now and just farm for the rest of his life, I think he would be quite pleased with that. I don't think he would have, you know, he's so good, like you said, he's almost obligated to play because he's so good. But he's like Boo Weekly like that. He's really, they could, they'd be just as happy away from the game than they would be, you know, off the course than they would be on the course.
Yeah, it feels almost that Louis and guys like Boo Weekly and so on as well, that's a good point. You know, those kind of guys, they almost play just so they can earn enough money to actually enjoy the lifestyle at home. You know, Boo plays golf so he can afford to go and hunt and so on and fish and whatever else he does, and wrestle alligators and grow a massive beard, whatever else the guy does. And Louis, as you say, he obviously enjoys his farm life. That's kind of a typical, you know, South African, you know, white guy in that respect. They all love their farms and so on. Gary Player is the same. Charles Watchell is the same. That's what they really enjoy.
Right.
And they enjoy that kind of countryside lifestyle. And Louis almost seems to actually play. He comes out and plays, earns some money, goes back to the farm and buys a new tractor. You know, it's a bit of a running joke, but there is an element of truth to it. As you say, it almost feels like, you know, the other players must stand, the really kind of dedicated, hard-working guys must stand on the range and look at him and just think, God, I hate you. I wish the game was so easy for me, you know?
Yeah.
But there are players like that, and but I say, these guys, even though he may not win a great number of events overall in his career, he can certainly win some more big ones. And in his career, you know, a guy I can say he's won at St. Andrews, almost won at the Augusta National. Anyone can do that is obviously up there with the great players of their generation. And I think Louis, in terms of his talent level, is unquestionably in the top 10 of his generation, because he may not be in terms of his record overall, but it's just his sheer ability. I mean, you watch him play, he's one of these players who you can stand and watch him play for hours and hours, because it's just, he makes the game look so easy. We all know how hard the game really is, and there is an element of jealousy to it, but it's also kind of an element of just wonderment of watching someone who can play the game just so well and so effortlessly. Obviously, there's a lot of, he does work hard in his game, you wouldn't be that good otherwise, but at the same time, he makes it so much easier looking than most players do.
No, I agree 100%, and I got to tell you, this was in terms of golfing weekend, if you couldn't enjoy the two swings of the two winners across the
Absolutely.
The water, across the pond on each side of the pond or whatever, across the, the other hemisphere, really, it was just amazing, watching, wake up to the swings of Louis Oosthuizen and then, end the evening with Adam Scott. It's ridiculous, really, actually.
Well, exactly. It's a bit like watching The Godfather Part 1 and The Godfather Part 2, that's
what it's like. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. It was, that's a good, good analogy. Before we end tonight, I just wanted to just, something I saw in the news, just wanted to get your opinion on. Augusta mm-hmm. National has been in.
Ah, yes.
Did you see that, where they're trying to grab some more land from Augusta Country Club to lengthen the 13th, and which traditionally plays around 500 and something yards, nothing too spectacular, but they want to put another tee back there. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's really disappointing, and an indication once again that for me the game has lost its way at the highest level. When Augusta National has obviously done it in the last sort of 2002, they bought some property from the neighbouring club and expanded the course slightly as well then, but to have to do it again, and people say to me all the time, the golf ball is going as far as it ever will. That's nonsense, and the proof of that is the fact that Augusta, after all the lengthening they've done in the past decade, want to do some more. It's unfortunate because for me the 13th hole is the greatest risk and reward par 5 in golf. It's an absolute masterpiece of a hole. It's my favourite hole on that golf course. I think it's one of maybe three or four holes on the course that are actually genuinely world class, and it's a stunner, and it's one of those courses where you want guys to go in there with a drive and a 6-iron, and that's kind of the optimum way to play that hole. That's the way it should be played. You give them a chance of actually hitting the green, and if not, obviously the penalty's harsh. And I think what we'll see with the hole being lengthened by 50 yards, that's not a problem for Bubba Watson and so on and those guys, but it's the other guys who are going to struggle with that. It's going to become a genuine free-shotter for them. They're not going to take that risk on, and that's a real problem for the tournament, because that's part of the great drama of Augusta National and watching the Masters every April, is seeing the guys, that kind of risk and reward aspect to the course. It's probably one of the ultimate risk and reward courses in the game, where there's such an element of danger to every single hole, but also an element of potential majesty and success. And no hole kind of illustrates that more than the 13th. And to lose that for most of the field would be extremely unfortunate. And it seems to be a response to Bubba, obviously, a couple of years ago, where he had that massive drive in the final day, and almost a drive and a flick onto the green with a wedge. Obviously, that would have shocked the organisers and the club there. But at the same time, you're trying to almost proof the course like they did with Tiger, from the longest hitters. But in the end, by doing that, by lengthening the course even further, all you're doing is benefiting the longer hitters again, even more. So it seems madness to me. And
I think the thing that gets lost there, though, Kieran, is that the fact that he had a, first of all, he doesn't do it every time. I mean, that drive, that's not an easy drive. I mean, he's got to control that cut, and he's either on the trees on the right, or he's out of bounds on the left. So it's not an easy shot. It's a little easier to cut it than it is to draw it. But it's still a shot that has to be, fairly manipulated with the driver. And so, if the more guys were doing it on a regular basis, where they were hitting 9-iron and wedge, that'd be a different story. But you're talking about, you're talking about not even 1% of the field that's able to, to get it down there in the first place. But nevertheless, in tournament conditions, as they like to say, you still have to manipulate that ball around that corner, and that's no easy feat. Mm. So I feel like, there's more to that than just lengthening the hole. They want to put part of it is they want to put a service road down there and whatnot. And some of it is basically for maintenance in terms of the facility. But obviously the new T would be definitely obviously part of the plan and probably the primary impetus for it. But, you know, it's not. I wouldn't jump to that conclusion just yet.
Well, the word I read, it was 50 yards they want to put the T back by. And you're right there, but the other stuff they want to do as well, the infrastructure, and that's a great thing, obviously, for them. They continually try and improve their facilities every single year.
Yeah.
And I've never been to the Masters. Anyone who goes off, it's an incredible facility, great experience for everybody. But at the same time, I just think it's sort of... It's happened before. They've obviously lengthened the course in the past throughout the decades, but it's happening at a greater rate than before. And to me, that was one of those holes that was almost a perfectionist hole. It was one of the great masterpieces there.
Yeah.
And to remove a little bit of the allure of that is unfortunate and probably unnecessary. And I've done it a lot of times as well. You know, they look at the 15th now, where they put more trees in there a few years ago and completely narrowed the driving area. And number 11 now as well, and the trees there are absolutely ridiculous. You know, that hole is a complete disaster now, really, from a technical standpoint. It's a terrible hole. And that's unfortunate because, you know, it goes back to the continuing kind of philosophical argument about technology and how far the ball goes and so on. And it's going to become an ever-increasing problem because to really contain the game, as it were, on these old-fashioned golf courses, you have to make them longer or trick them up even more. And the greens at Augusta National are as tricked up as they ever can be. You can't make them any faster or any more undulating. And we saw it at the Open Championship last year at St Andrews. You know, they got the scoring there was relatively within, you know, obviously, you know, not record-breaking levels, but at the same time, it was so bunched up because, and again, the scoring wasn't record-breaking for the simple reason that the pins are put in really stupid places and the course is playing in a way that it really was never intended to be done so.
Right.
And for me, in the next sort of 5 to 10 years, the players are getting bigger, stronger, you know, more athletic, faster swings, hit the ball further. Technology is continuing to improve at a certain rate. You know, it may stop eventually, but I still think there's a window for improvement in that regard. And at the same time, this is going to be a bigger issue in the next 10, 15 years. We see more golf courses being stretched to their limits, and it's putting a massive, you know, a massive cost on it, because a club like Augusta National can afford it, obviously, but many places can't. And the game of golf at the highest level now is becoming, for me, less interesting. And it's a bit like having desecrating a great piece of art, and that's just unfortunate to me.
Yep.
I must quickly say, Anthony, about the back to the Honda Classic indeed. Wasn't it amazing? We actually spoke about the Honda Classic there for 10, 15 minutes, a good discussion, without ever mentioning the mousetrap. Whatever it's called.
Yeah. Yes, it's amazing how I thought that David Faraday, I don't know if you caught the golf NBC broadcast, you're probably watching on the BBC or whatever it is that you watch over there. And so, but David Faraday did a little bit of was mocking the names of the golf courses. So, like, you know, basically we should rename the bear trap the laxative or something like that. You know, things of that nature, obviously, and or maybe the embolism or something like that. And so I think his point is well taken. Like, it's ridiculous. These things, these names are just, you know. And it was almost like, you know, it's just typical of, the excessive American way. And that's because it wasn't enough to have Amen Corner, right? We couldn't just leave Amen Corner at the Masters, and that was it. And then everybody else had needed to have a corner, and then everybody else needs to have a nickname and this and that. So then we had the bear trap, and then we have the snake pit. And it's like, you know, and the green mile, with the green mile at Wells Fargo, I think it was, or something.
Yeah,
you know, something
that's
ridiculous,
right.
Like, you know, and it's like, you know, things are special because there are not many of them, or there's only one of them. There's only one Amen Corner. You know, not everything needs to be a marketing tool. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd.
It is, and you're right. And the Green Mile in particular always amuses me. I'm always waiting to see Tom Hanks or Michael Clark Duncan appear from the swamp, you know, and cheer the guys on, but it's never happened yet.
No.
But the same thing, you're right. Amen Corner is organic. It has a historical factor to it. It feels natural.
Of course.
The rest of them feel contrived. And that's the problem with that. And, you know, the bear trap's obviously ridiculous. But at the same time, it feels almost appropriate in a way because the Revenant, the DiCaprio film, was widely expected to win most of the Academy Awards. So, and that famously has a very large and impressive bear in it. So I guess that's quite appropriate that way. But at the same time, it's It's ridiculously contrived, but and I must say, the snake pit, whose idea was that? What does that even mean?
You know whose idea that was? That was Stuart Armstrong's idea. That was, I believe.
Was it really?
I believe it was.
You know what? I don't believe it.
Yeah, I believe it was. I think he coined the phrase, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I must say, I wonder, perhaps Stuart can tweet us one of these days. I bet Stuart has actually named a freehold stretch at his local golf course, Cow Glen in Glasgow. He's probably given that a name as well.
I'm sure.
I don't think what it could be, though.
Well, there's nothing stopping him now. Now he names everything. All right, that's all we got for this week. I am Anthony Scorsia, the On Par Winter Podcast, and my counterpart on the other side of the pond is Kieran. You can get him at golfshake.com, or you can get him on Twitter at Kieran Clark Golf. Kieran, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining me, and I look forward to catching you next week.
We
can't wait for next week. Your buddy's place, Trump Doral.
Well, the blue monster indeed, or perhaps the big orange moth, the big orange monster, perhaps more appropriate for that.
Yeah, the marshmallow. Yeah, you got that right. All right, Kieran, take care, buddy.
Cheers.
Cheers.